So, meine Damen und Herren, es freut mich, Sie begrüßen zu dürfen, die übergroße Mehrheit hier von Ihnen. Also wir kennen uns persönlich von vergangenen Jahren, von Kennenlernen in Basel, in München, auf der Straße in Jerusalem, in Frankfurt oder sonst noch wo. Es freut mich, Sie alle wieder zu sehen. Oder manchmal in Griechenland zum letzten Mal gesehen. Okay. Ich habe hier Quellen, die werden bald... This is the English section?
Yes.
Very good. So I'm going to start again. Okay. Instructions for whoever is recording. Cut here and start again. You know. Ladies and gentlemen, what a pleasure to see you here. The vast majority of you, I actually have the great fortune to know personally. I've gotten to know you in Basel, in Munich, on the streets of Jerusalem. Get to know better. In Frankfurt, or sometimes people, they, you know, we've known each other for a while already, but to meet at the last time in Greece, it's a great pleasure seeing you again. I have collected sources that will be useful for our shiur today. I would like to begin, however, with a short introduction. Although I planned it before the terrible events of this past Friday night, it's unfortunately very appropriate to mention it. Back on the 11th of September 2001, I lived in the Lower East Side of New York with a beautiful view of downtown Manhattan and an unfortunate, terrible view of the Twin Towers burning down and crashing, which my wife and I each saw one of the two towers crashing. And as anyone who has lived in at that time in New York, we knew people who worked there, who should have been there, who might have been there, could have been there, and who also people who unfortunately were there. And so we each have a catalog of stories from people that luckily were not there that day, or were there as the nephew of a cousin by marriage, once removed, who worked on the top of the World Trade Center of the second tower. Not the first one that was hit, the second one. And as the plane hit, there was an alarm for a brief time, and then people were told, it's okay, you can stay in your office. But he remembered being at the World Trade Center 8 years earlier, in 1993, when there was a bomb attack. And since that, they had done some security drills. He said, I'm doing this properly. And he walked down 100 floors. And after he walked down 100 floors, he was tired. He did it quickly, I don't know, 10 minutes. He was tired, and he went to get a coffee. And that coffee saved his life, because that's when the plane said, I mean, there are a lot of stories like that. And they raise instantly the question of what providence is, how common it is, ought to be, and how to deal with it in life when sometimes we don't see the hand of providence. And so therefore, I'd like to tell the following story of a friend who posted this on an email discussion group a couple of days later and says, you know, on the 11th of September was Sliches time, and I wanted to go to an extra early minyan so I'd still make it comfortably to work. Unfortunately, that extra early minyan didn't work out. There was no minyan. I ended up in a later minyan than usual, plus Sliches. By the time I was coming into Manhattan, traffic was terrible. And while I was sitting in traffic, the plane hit. By the way, now for those of you who know New York, this will explain lots of it. By the way, my office was at 34th Street. That's like 50 blocks, 60 blocks away, 50 blocks from the World Trade Center. And the lesson he was trying to impart was, we're used to looking at stories where something happened in the last second. And that makes us notice the hand of providence. Why is it any less providential that he has his job 50 blocks away? Come to think of it. In fact, based on something we will be reading 2 weeks from now, in Vayishlach, where Yaakov says, I am too unworthy of all the great good things you do with me, Yaakov says to God, And the commentaries catch on to this and explain Yaakov was worried that he used up his merits, his credits in a miracle bank account, and therefore might not merit anymore being saved. And by the way, this is also a reason why it has always bothered me, or has long bothered me, when I hear these stories about Abu Chatzera pouring arak without end, or Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, whenever he was in a car, the car never needed fuel. Theologically, it doesn't make any sense, because let's assume it's possible. Why would, you know, miracle credits go out the window for such things that are so trivial? So that set aside, I do want to use these stories to open up the question of how common providence is. We're all familiar with the view of 18th century authorities, people like the Baal Shem Tov, the Gaon of Vilna, with slight differences between them, that consider providence ubiquitous. Providence is everywhere to be seen. The Baal Shem Tov is particularly extreme in that sense, and you can find it in the books of a number of the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov, including, for example, in the Tanya, but also in a bunch of other places, that everything that happens on earth, every little thing, every leaf that rustles, every seed that falls and ends up somewhere from where a tree might or might not grow, everything imaginable is all preordained in a sense. Everything is providence. It's as much as saying there is no nature. It's a very beautiful, awe-inspired vision of the world. The only problem is, for us, we're used to work with scientific mechanisms, it is a little taxing. If you say that everything is miracle, everything is exceptional, then there ought not to be a system that can explain it. Once you have a system, it becomes something regular. It becomes, well, let's not call it the law of nature. At the very least, it would be a law of providence. It will no longer be a direct intervention. It's something that happens automatically. And so therefore, is the Baal Shem Tov's the only valid view? The Gaon of Vilna is not quite as extreme. The Gaon of Vilna considers that providence applies only to people and anything that touches people. But still, every single event in the life of a person is providential. So, in our experience, we do find regularity in nature as it relates to us. That's why we visit the doctor occasionally. That's why some of us exercise and others make resolutions about exercise. That's why we service our cars and we fuel up and so forth. And so therefore, we wonder, is that the only traditional Jewish view, or are there alternatives? Well, what's very, very, very interesting is, if we go back a couple of hundred years, we go from the 18th century back to the 12th and 13th centuries. I could have broadened it, but then I would have needed a couple more hours. Could have started with Lafsadia Gaon and mentioned a couple of other authorities. We will limit ourselves to two people, to Rambam and Ramban. We find a well-known divergence of views, neither of which consider providence as ubiquitous as the Baal Shem Tov or the Gaon of Vilna. Let's begin with an easy one. So I have sources here. If someone wants to help me distribute them, I will appreciate. Shalom Aleichem, welcome to Basel. It's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
In considering the extent of providence, we ought to ask another question also, what the purpose of providence is. But one of the possibilities, of course, and the sources discuss that, both Rambam and Ramban discuss this quite explicitly, one reason to consider providence ubiquitous is because when you have providence left, right, and center all the time, you can build in, you can understand that there is a significant proportion of reward and punishment happening in this life. So theologically, it's very attractive. It also allows us to interpret several passages in Tanakh quite literally. When we're talking about Vayem Shamoa Tishmael Mitzvotai Shanachem Tzavet Chamayom, if we keep the mitzvahs, so at that point, we will be rewarded with agricultural plenty, with material success, material wealth. And if we transgress all the mitzvahs and we go and we actually violate our bond with God and worship idols, then things will be terrible and we'll be expelled from the land and so forth. It's very, that text, as well as many others, are very, very here and now texts. So it is convenient theologically if I could maintain that providence is ubiquitous. The only problem is we're not the first ones to mention or to realize that often in life, life does not seem to work out in accordance to what reward and punishment ought to make happen. This, we're not the first ones to ask the question of theodicy, nor did our grandparents, our great-grandparents. Tehillim is full of it. There are two particular Pirkei Tehillim you should compare to each other in order to see how profound it is Tehillim Ayin Gimel, 73, and Mizmor Shir Li Yom HaShabbos, 92. Read first 73. No, read them like this. Read first Mizmor Shir Li Yom HaShabbos. Ask yourself what it's about. Then read Ayin Gimel, and then read Mizmor Shir Li Yom HaShabbos again and try to find the similarities. You'll have a lot of fun. For extra explanations, you can download a shir to that mizmor from my website. Anyway, the question of theodicy is clearly being asked in the days of the Balei HaTehillim. It's being asked, Chazal explained, that Moshe Rabbeinu himself was wondering about the question of theodicy. Why is there a so-called tzaddik v'ralo? There is a righteous person who suffers. And for that matter, Rosh HaVatovlo, why? How could there be evil people, wicked people who are doing well? The question has been with us throughout history. And so therefore, maybe theologically, once you realize the fact, theologically, a ubiquitous providence is less interesting. It's very clear that reward and punishment, based on our experience, ought to happen not just in this life, but extend into, you know, after final judgment of every soul. Okay, so therefore, we can ask the question, what's the purpose of providential events? And this is the first question we'll be asking, and see, first of all, what Rambam's view is of that. So I'm going straight to the English. The first source, Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, Perek Ches, Halacha Aleph. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, our teacher, was not believed in by the Jews because of the signs he performed. For one who believes in anything because of signs has a defect in his heart. In other words, belief that is based on miracles, according to Rambam, belief based on miracles is a deficient belief. Since it is possible that a sign was done through trickery and magic. And by the way, the Rambam does not believe in magic. When he says magic, he means illusion. Disillusionment. We're talking about all kind of trickery. Rather, all the signs that Moses did in the desert were done out of necessity, not to prove his prophecy. It was necessary to drown the Egyptians, so he split the sea and he made them sink in it. We needed to be fed, so the manna was brought down. The rebels among our ancestors were thirsty, so he split the stone for them, and water came forth. The congregation of Korach denied Moshe's authority, so the earth swallowed them. All these miracles were there for a contingent reason. There was a need for them, it was exceptional, and therefore it happened. And so too by all the other signs. So why do we believe in him? Why do we believe in Moshe's prophecy? And by extension, why do we believe in God and in Torah? At Mount Sinai, that which our eyes saw, and not a stranger's, that which our ears heard, and not another's, was the fire, the thunder, the lightning, and then Moshe approached the fog, and the voice of God spoke to him, and we heard, Moshe, Moshe, go and say to them such and such. Rambam's position is that the anchor of our Jewish faith is the public experience of prophecy at the revelation at Mount Sinai. That is the view of Rambam. If you look in a later source, in Ramban, turn over the page or you look at the next one. We have here the commentary of Ramban to Shemos Yud Gimel, 13th chapter, 16th verse. I'm just reading the highlights. You can go through the rest. V'chasher yirtze Elokim beida ubeyachid. When God desires a group or an individual, v'yaseh imayim mofet, and He will do with them, perform for them a miracle, b'shinui minago shel olam v'tiv'o, changing the habits of the world, you know, something different from nature, paranormal, abnormal, exceptional, miraculous. Yitbarer l'chol bitul ha'deot ha'ele kulam. Everyone will realize that their false beliefs are indeed false. Ki ha'mofet ha'nifla more sheyesh la'olam eloka mechadsho. The miracle proves that God is an antecedent to nature. God created nature. Because God created nature and the laws of nature, God can decide to overrule, to modify, or to make an exception to the rules of nature. It's true. We don't often experience that. But for Ramban, the notion of the miracle is crucial for belief. Because it proves the primacy of God as the creator. Primacy of God, therefore God being the creator of everything. That is the view of Ramban. Now, obviously, Ramban was also very well aware that biblical miracles are exceedingly rare. In fact, that's why we call them biblical miracles. We find them in Tanakh. We don't tend to find them every day. So the next bolded, highlighted line in that source, Umin anisim agdolim, from the great miracles, hamafursamim, that are well known, public, Adam modeh b'nisim anistarim. That teaches one to recognize that there are a lot of little miracles, hidden miracles, miracles that seem natural. Shehem yesod ha'Torah kula. They're at the basis of our entire Torah experience. She'ein la'adam chelek b'Torat Moshe Rabbeinu, ad she'na'amin b'chol devareinu u'mikreinu she'kulam nisim, ein ba'em teva u'minagoh shel olam. A very sweeping statement. We do not have part in the Torah of Moshe. In other words, we are severely delinquent in our obligation towards God and to His Torah. We are severely misunderstanding or lacking in our understanding of Judaism if we do not believe that miracles are ubiquitous everywhere and they're the basis of our entire relationship with God. Two very, very different views. In fact, right now, it really seems like Ramban is the logical predecessor, progenitor of the Baal Shem Tov's view. I think we're kind of in agreement. We have two very, very different views. Okay, we'll find out if that's true. So let's try to continue going back to page one to understand better, not miracles now, but providence. Because we went in the source we just read from Ramban, we slid from miracles as either foundation for faith or something that's irrelevant to faith, to going from the big miracles to the small miracles. You remember that? From the big miracles, from contemplating major miracles, we get to recognize small miracles, but the small miracles are what create, what express providence. So let's find out what Rambam thinks about providence. So now, before I continue, I couldn't possibly cite all the relevant sources or you'd have a book. So let me make very clear. Just about all Jewish thinkers agree that there are miracles. We may distinguish how we define them. There's a very distant position from Ralbag, Rabbi Levi Ben Gershon, who severely minimizes miracles. He doesn't do away with them altogether, but he severely minimizes them, interprets them in a very, very naturalistic way. But Ralbag is way out as a thinker from anything in a larger mainstream of how we've considered Jewish thought for centuries. So therefore, with the exception of Ralbag, I can calmly say just about every Jewish thinker of note, at least those who, are believers, part of the traditional community throughout the centuries, all agree they're miracles. There's only a question of how common they are and how important they are theologically. So they can be ubiquitous, as Baal Shem Tov says, and as Ramban said in the source we just saw, or they can be rare, as Rambam says, and not very necessary, but it's necessary, it's very clear that God can overrule nature. There's no question about that. A couple of years ago, at the Shomrei, I gave a rather lengthy shiur that I then broke up in two, about Torah and science, where I presented different models on how to harmonize what we learn from Ma'asev Rishit, from the account of creation, and from scientific knowledge. I presented different models. The last model, I presented four different models, and I came with a fifth one. You can hear two recordings of that lengthy shiur on my website. The last model I present, maybe you'll most readily, or many of you might most readily understand what it means if I mention to you the name of a movie, The Matrix. I called it the programmer's model of creation. We live in a simulation. Well, there are ways to deal with miracles without denying science. You have different systems that are superimposed one on top of the other, and it kind of philosophically works so beautifully. I just want to make sure that we understand these views are all sensible. The question is which one is most convincing for us right now, and what are the choices. So I am now turning to our second source from the Moreh Nevuchim, Guide to the Perplexed, third volume, 51st chapter. It's almost the very end of the Moreh Nevuchim. And again, I will concentrate on the bolded lines. He tries to work out what is providence and how common it is. And so Rambam says, there are people who are perfect in their perception of God. Rambam is very, very intellectual. For Rambam, the purpose of life is to intellectually grasp and connect with God. We cannot fully grasp God, but we should grasp as much as we can and deepen our understanding throughout our lives. And the ultimate reward, by the way, another point, very, very important, is that for Rambam, evil is so-called privation, the lack of good. When there's no good, there is evil. But really, evil is not an independent reality. The good is the only reality, and actually the good is to be identified with knowledge. And so Rambam says, those who are perfect in their perception of God, whose mind is never separated from him, and enjoy always the influence of providence. So there is a group of people that are constantly living a providential life. These people are perfect in their faith, in their intellectual commitment, in the way they live their intellectual commitment. There is no disconnect between actions and thought. They are fine 24 hours a day. But those who perfect in their knowledge of God turn their mind sometimes away from God, enjoy the presence of divine providence only when they meditate on God. When their thoughts are engaged in other matters, divine providence departs from them. The absence of providence in this case is not like its absence in the case of those who do not reflect on God at all. It is, in this case, less intense. In other words, there are people who are perfect. People who are perfect live constantly a life of providence. But you know what? Who is perfect? Yeah, we got a problem. And so therefore, the less people are perfect, the more their moments in life that are not filled with divine awareness, with divine our awareness of God, with connection to God. And these moments create an experience where we're not subject to providence. And then says Rambam, this, by the way, is very shocking to people who are steeped in the thought of the Baal Shem Tov. He ends up saying that there are also those, the next bolded line, who have no knowledge of God. And they are like those who are in constant darkness and have never seen light. In other words, they never experience providence. You know what we just said? The Gaon of Vilna was not going as far as the Baal Shem Tov. He said, not every grass, every straw, or every bird is subject to providence, but the human experience is fully subject to providence. And here we see Rambam saying, a lot of people are so not living a sanctified life, and that includes many people, I think us most of the time, unfortunately, that people, there are even people who are never subject to providence. Well, otherwise, you know, the middle group, we hope we can aspire to be in the middle group, more or less providence in life. But not everything that happens to us is providential. Certain things that happen are providential, and other things are just happenstance. Because one of the results of not living a sanctified moment is not to be subject to providence and therefore to be subject to happenstance. It could be good, it could be bad, it's just random. Pretty amazing. So now again, we have two views. We have Rambam, both on the level of the importance of miracles, as well as on how common they are. On one hand, Rambam saying miracles not important, they just happened because there was a special need for them and they were exceptional. And that providence is, let's call it rare, it happens. There are some very holy people who are constantly subject to providence. Really, otherwise, people experience moments of providence in their lives, more or less moments, but it's only moments of providence. Now that we've seen Rambam, we want to get to deepen our understanding of Ramban. So I'm going now to the fourth source. It's on the bottom of page 2. I mentioned that theologically it's attractive. Before we take experience into account, it's theologically very attractive to believe in a constant providence, because it allows us to explain certain passages in the Torah as pure literal pshat. No need to speak of judgment, you know, after one dies. It just, everything happens in this life. So Ramban is going to stress this here. Ein min ha-teva she-yavo ha-gshamim be-itam bo-avdeinu elukim. Is there any law of nature that says just because we're praying at the right time and we're saying the right things and keeping the right mitzvah, serving God, therefore the rain comes? And is there any law of nature that dictates that if we sow our fields on Shemitah, on a sabbatical year, that suddenly there won't be any rain? You have a lot of these kind of statements in the Torah about what would happen contingent upon our behavior. The only way you can interpret that is to say this is happening on the level of miracle. However, you should be aware, it's simply that those miracles that bring the rain at the right time and so forth are simply not as public, they're not as clear, they're not as abnormal as the biblical miracles. Note, by the way, which miracles Ramban mentions as being the supernatural miracles, they're exactly the same one that the Ramban mentioned in the first source. The 10 plagues in Egypt, splitting the sea, the man, and the water coming out of the rock. In other words, you're going to see it more explicitly, Ramban read Rambam. He lived the next century. He read Rambam. He was very well aware. And he was basing himself, departing from, agreeing, disagreeing with Rambam. So he says, those that Moses did, Arshe, Moftim, Mishani, Mateva, Bifirsum, they publicly changed nature. But you can have also hidden miracles. They're still miracles. Okay? Up until now, we've created a tremendous dichotomy. Rambam one side, Ramban the other side. Rambam the rationalist, Ramban the mystic who sees miracles left, right, and center. The problem is that the very same Ramban, in his very same commentary on the Torah, not very far from the source we just read, which was in the 17th chapter of Bereshis, now we're going to the 18th chapter of Bereshis, where Parshas Vayera, we just read 2 weeks ago. Ramban says the following thing. By the way, this is on a very, very important verse I love to cite, where God explains why he's telling Avram about the upcoming destruction of Sodom. And that is one of the foundational verses explaining why Avram was chosen, and therefore we became the chosen people as his descendants. So on that verse, on that very, very significant verse, which begins with Ki Yedativ, that I know about him, so we can talk about divine knowledge, says Ramban, Yediat Hashem, again the bold type, Shi Ashgachato Ba'olam HaShafel. The knowledge of God is to be taken quasi as synonymous with providence, with how God deals with, modifies the world we're in. And what is it? Lishmor haklalim. Wow. You know what klal is? It's a general rule. It's the opposite of providence. In fact, a century earlier, Rambam distinguished between hashgacha pratit and hashgacha klalit, between providence or individual providence that applies to a person or a group, and hashgacha klalit or hashgacha minit is just that God makes sure that nature continues to work. There's a need for, we need cows so we can eat meat and drink milk. So God makes sure that cows survive, at least until we invent a machine in the lab to produce, steak without the cow. And there's a need for, there's a need for bees. So even when they're endangered, they somehow still make it. And until we, kill them off and invent different methods, We tend to ruin things a little bit. But nonetheless, God makes sure that as much as possible, the world continues functioning as it's supposed to function. And there are people in the world, and there is a nation of Israel. There are quite a number of people over the hundreds of years. I know there's a very famous statement by Mark Twain, who was marveling at how our Jewish people have survived all those major empires that rose and declined and departed, have disappeared, but we're still here. That's hashgacha klalit, that the major things happen. So says Ramban, Yidiat Hashem, God knows and follows. That's Lishmor HaKlalim. Then there is also Hashgacha Klalit and Hashgacha Pratit, namely, V'gam ne'adam munachim bo le'mikrim. People are subject to mikrim, to happenstance, to accident. Ad bo et pkudatam. There is a time when they should be remembered. In other words, there are moments when people are subject to providence, but most of the time not. Aval bechasidav yasum elav libo ladat oto biprat. The pious people, they are subject to hashgacha pratit. Liot shmirato vekobot tamid, because they're always trying to cleave to God, lo tiparet ha'idiyah v'azra mimenu klal, and so therefore, just like the people try to cleave to God, so God doesn't ever, in quotation marks, forget them for a moment. And this is, wow. It's like now the man suddenly seems to say the opposite. He seems to be more reserved about providence than Rambam, than Maimonides. We thought Maimonides was the one who had only occasionally providence. We see Ramban expresses himself in a way that kind of contradicts what he said until now. Now there's a little known commentary of Ramban. If you look at the well-known edition of the commentary of Ramban from Mossad Rav Kook, there are these two blue volumes, light blue and dark blue. I don't know if some of you may know what I'm talking about. So there are not just two volumes, there are four volumes. There are two volumes that are the Pirush al HaTorah, and there are two volumes that are Kisvei Ramban, the writings of Ramban. They're very, very interesting. A lot fewer people read them. They contain, for example, the account of his disputation with Pablo Cristiani, the apostate Jew before the king of Spain, which Ramban handily won, but forced, despite the assurances he had from the king, he had to flee. You have famous speeches of Ramban. You have a couple of other writings, letters, and you also have a commentary to Iov. And in the commentary to Iov, which deals, after the whole book deals with providence, there is a view in the Talmud that the story of Iov never happened. There are different views when it happened, when Iov lived, and one view is it never happened. And it seems to be the idea that this was God's prophetic gift to Moshe, when Moshe could not understand why righteous people suffer. In other words, this is a foundational theological text. Maybe it did happen. You know, there are different views that place Iov in various historical periods. But I just want, we should all appreciate how Iov is a foundational Jewish theological text. And in his commentary to Iov, Ramban says the following, and I'm again going to read just the highlighted, bolded text. For people of Torah and perfect faith believe in providence. That is, that God watches over and protects the members of the human species. Whoops! So first of all, providence is important to believe in. And then he says, Hashgacha klalit. Now God is involved in nature. God is involved in the world. Takes care of the generalities. Sets up laws. Makes sure that you know, people remain alive. There are still people of Israel. There are other things going on. It is not said in the Torah, the prophets, that God watches over and protects the individuals of other groups of creatures that do not speak. So first of all, this is a clear contradiction to the view of the Baal Shem Tov. God relates less directly to other creatures. He guards only the species. And this then is why he protects, in the next bolded citation, this then is why he protects the righteous, for just as their heart and eyes are always with him, so are the eyes of God on them from the beginning of the year until the end, to the point where the absolutely pious man, the chassid, who cleaves to his God always and who never separates himself from him in his thoughts by paying attention to mundane matters, will be guarded always from all accidents, even those that take place in the natural course of events. Such a person will be protected from these accidents through a miracle occurring to him constantly. However, if we skip to the last line, those who are close to God are under absolute protection, while those who are far from him are subject to accidents and have no one to protect them from harm, just as one who walks in the darkness is likely to fall unless he's cautious and walks slowly. And, very, very remarkable, Ramban cites a verse from David HaMelech. I think that's remarkable because it means that David HaMelech also was struggling with the issue of providence. And David HaMelech was a great righteous man, the paramount Baal Tshuva, the person who could really, when facing major embarrassment, willingly accept the embarrassment and say, I was wrong. This is one of the greatness of David HaMelech and sets the bar for what we expect of the Jewish king. Shaul was very great, but Shaul couldn't quite say as clearly, I erred, I was wrong. Shaul was constantly worried about what the nobles would say, was trying to get their, not to disappoint them and to keep their allegiance. David HaMelech is the king of the people and the one who is not afraid to say I was wrong. So David HaMelech struggles with providence. Well, if David HaMelech struggles with the issue, I think that it's okay. It's okay. We should aim to be of those who are always subject to providence, but if we haven't gotten there yet, I think we're in good company. We should still aim, to get further ahead. Most of the world belongs to this intermediate group. The Torah commanded that warriors be mobilized and that the priests anointed for war send back the fearful so that they will not sap the courage of others. It is for this reason, too, that we find the preparation of the order of battle in the Torah and the prophets. So, we've come full circle. It turns out that Ramban is, despite very radical statements we saw in the beginning, and we're going to have to make sense out of them, he's very, very close to Rambam. Mm-hmm. I'll show you why, as the last line says it. In this case, however, they deserve to be treated in the manner of nature and accident, talking about the people who are very far from God. This is a matter which was explained well by Maimonides in the Guide of the Perplexed. Ramban read Rambam. And Ramban did not come to massively depart, in this case, from Rambam. He's not shy of disagreement, disagreeing with Rambam. There's a whole commentary of the Ramban to the Sefer HaMitzvos, to the list of all the commandments which Rambam compiled. And Ramban was never shy to disagree even on very foundational questions and how to identify which is a mitzvah and which is not, or which is a mitzvah for all generations or not. There are quite a number of disagreements between them. But it doesn't mean he always disagrees. And here the Ramban came to provide a subtle disagreement with Rambam, to deepen our understanding of the matter. He disagrees with Rambam on the importance of miracles. For Ramban, miracles are very important. For Rambam, it's important that they're possible. For Ramban, it's important that they have happened. Because we need to know that humans have experienced miracles. And then, the other side is, Rambam believes that evil is privation, is the absence of good. Ramban believes that very wicked people are also subject to providence in order to punish them. And that means that for Ramban, evil is real. And just like evil is real, it cannot be ignored, and the wicked people cannot just be ignored. You cannot just leave them to happenstance. They need to be dealt with, and that's why there's providence for them too. So, this is what I prepared for you today. And I will finish with the last citation, which would prove what we all said. Ki anisim, all the way at the end, lo yasu lo tova lo ra, rak la tzedikim gmurim, o la rishayim gmurim. It's the righteous and the wicked who are subject to most providence. And all the others are somewhere in between. Sometimes we hope to merit it. We do see moments of the hand of God. I think all of us have had moments in life where we see something very providential happened. But we're not on that level to claim to be constant that everything is providence all the time. Of course, as I said at the beginning, in the 18th century, the dominant view is very different. Both are legitimate Jewish philosophical inclinations. And I think at that point, I can leave it to you to feel what you feel most drawn to at which part of your life, because we also sometimes change our opinions.